anybody in the Native community that knows traditional Yupik people know that their spirituality and their beliefs are a core part of who they are.
A state appeals court hears why Yupik fishermen defied a closure to catch salmon. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 26th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the Constitution Party makes it onto the November ballot for the governor's race.
I've been telling people from the beginning we don't have a snowball's chance to take the race. It's really about establishing this party.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
And by
Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
Attorneys argued before the Alaska Court of Appeals in downtown Anchorage today about whether Yupik fishermen who targeted Chinook or King Salmon during a closure on the Kuskokwim River in 2012 were wrongfully convicted. Attorney James Davis with the Northern Justice Project, an Anchorage-based private civil rights law firm, represented the fishermen. He said that the state should have tried to accommodate the fishermen's religious beliefs.
The primary issue before this court is whether the state of Alaska had a duty under the Free Exercise Clause to accommodate the Yupik Fisher spiritual practices under the Frank versus State case and its progeny, and whether, in fact, the state did so. We submit that the state had a duty but failed to comply with that duty.
Due to a reduced run of king salmon, the state closed the Lower Kuskokwim River subsistence fishery in June of 2012. Fishing for king salmon is a key part of Yupik spirituality. Dozens of people fished in defiance of the state closure. Many were given fines, and some nets were confiscated. A few days later, the state opened the area to fishing for other species of salmon, which allowed about 20,000 king salmon to be caught as bycatch. The trial court agreed that king salmon fishing is integral to the Yupik religion, but convicted the fishermen and decided that Alaska's need to protect king salmon overrode the fishermen's religious rights. 13 decided to pursue an appeal. Attorney Laura Fox with the State Attorney General's office argued that issuing citations for fishing during an emergency closure was needed to protect king salmon.
The 2012 Kuskokwim king salmon run was so weak and the numbers were so far from meeting the escapement objective that to say the state should have allowed more harvest is to completely disregard the public trust responsibility to manage that resource for sustained yield. There was never any harvestable surplus of kings in 2012, and at the end of the day, the state missed the escapement objective by 50,000 fish.
The ACLU, the Association of Village Council Presidents, and the Alaska Federation of Natives have filed amicus briefs in the case. Julie Kitka, president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, attended the hearing. She says AFN supports the Yupik fishermen.
Anybody in the Native community that knows traditional Yupik people know that their spirituality and their beliefs are a core part of who they are. And with everything that they do, how they treat their parents, how they treat their children, how they treat their neighbors, how they treat food sources and nature and animals that give themselves up to them. So we're sadness is in the court system, but we hope the justices will give some consideration to them.
A panel of three judges will weigh the arguments in the case of David Phillip versus the state of Alaska and issue a decision likely sometime later this year or early next year. An ad running against Senator Mark Begich attacks him on his support for women, exactly where he proclaims his strength. The ad by Crossroads GPS says he favors men when it comes to setting salaries for his Senate staff. APRN's Liz Ruskin looked into it and confirmed Begich does have a pay gap.
Senator Begich attended a rally in Anchorage this week to mark National Women's Equality Day. He called for an end to gender pay disparities.
And we cannot continue in this country to have this inequities when it comes to men and women, when it's pay, benefits, and everything else. So you're going to find me working double time every single day.
Crossroads GPS, an independent political group affiliated with Karl Rove, says Begich doesn't live by the principle he preaches.
Begich pays his female Senate staff 71 cents for every dollar he pays men. On average, women working for Senator Begich make $23,000 less than men.
In an interview after the rally, Begich refuted those numbers.
Well, I don't know where he got that data. I know, I can tell you, when you go job to job, classification to classification, in some of our categories, we pay women 108%. In other words, more than men. I'm sure he'll run an ad on that next, and I don't pay men enough.
In Washington, senators set the salaries for their staff within an overall office budget. A review of staff salaries for the first half of the fiscal year shows, on average, Begich does pay men more. There are endless ways to crunch the numbers, but excluding interns and part-timers, APRN found he pays men an average annual salary of nearly $80,000 and women $64,000. That comes to 82 cents on the dollar. It was about the same last year, too. Begich says it skews the numbers when you include what is far and away the top salary, $153,000 for Chief of Staff David Ramser. When that one is excluded, the wage gap shrinks, but it still comes to 89 cents on the dollar. Begich does have a lot of women on staff, nearly double the number of men, and they're not just in the entry-level spots. Looking at his 10 best-paid staffers, half are women. As for Begich's claim that he actually pays women a bit more for the same position, that is true in some cases and when looking at the same position over several years. But right now, there's only one job title held by several men and several women. It's legislative assistant, and there are seven of them. The men who hold that position make $6,000 more per year than the women on average. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaskans will have one more option in the governor's race. The Division of Elections will allow Constitution Party candidate J.R. Myers to appear on the ballot. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
The Alaska Constitution Party has just over 200 members, and it was first recognized by the state in 2011. Because the right-wing organization is so new and so small, it doesn't qualify as a political party under statute. Instead, it's lumped in with the Green Party and Veterans Party as a political group, a sort of electoral purgatory where candidates have to collect signatures to get their names on the ballot. Myers and his lieutenant governor running mate, Maria Rensel, each turned in over 4,000 names, exceeding the threshold set by the Division of Elections to run for office. Rensel says they're not looking to win the governor's race. Instead, they're aiming for a more manageable 3% of the vote. That would upgrade their party status and guarantee them an automatic spot on the ballot next cycle.
I've been telling people from the beginning we don't have a snowball's chance to take the race. It's really about establishing this party.
Rensel is also the vice chair of the party, and she adds that signature gathering was a good exercise, even if they want to avoid going through it again. The Constitution Party started collecting signatures in February, and they've upped their number of registered voters by 40. While that's not a lot in the context of the Republican and Democratic parties, it amounts to a 25% increase in membership for them.
It was the whole opportunity to get out and talk to people and see how many people were ready for this party.
The Constitution Party also has one legislative candidate who will appear on the ballot. Pamela Good got the necessary 50 signatures to run in House District 9, which stretches from Delta Junction to Valdez. The Constitution Party is politically conservative, with an explicitly Christian worldview. It has achieved some success in other states. In 2010, former Congressman Tom Tancredo ran for governor in Colorado as a Constitution Party candidate and took nearly 40% of the vote. In Anchorage, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the giant pumpkin at this year's fair just misses tying a giant record.
Yeah, I thought it was going to weigh a little bit more, but oh well, you know. Proud I had them this year. Yeah, I really did.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at Alaska.bp.com.
The state of Alaska is requesting to be involved with Canadian approval of a proposed copper and gold mine across the border in British Columbia. State commissioners of three departments submitted comments on Seabridge's Gold's Kerr Sulphurets Mitchell, or KSM, mine this month. That open-pit mine is planned in the Unuk and Nass River watersheds across the border from Ketchikan. Alaska's congressional delegation, fishing industry, and tribal groups have asked for a more detailed review of that project following a tailings dam failure at a different mine in British Columbia this month. KFSK's Joe Vicnicki reports.
Fishing industry and tribal groups are asking for what's called a panel review of the gold and copper project near the Unuk and Nass River watersheds. Such a review could include public hearings and independent assessment of the mining development. The Petersburg Vessel Owners Association's Brian Lynch wants to prevent a tailings dam failure like the one that happened at the Mount Pauley mine.
The panel review is the only thing that I think would give us any kind of assurance that we're not going to have something like that happen. There's no guarantees, but I think it's just, you know, would be if the KSM mine is actually fully constructed, that would be the only thing that would give us any kind of assurances that, you know, the water quality will not be impaired for either the Unuk or the Nass River.
KSM received approval from the British Columbia provincial government this summer. The Canadian federal government still has to decide on that project. The PVOA, Alaska Trollers Association, tribal organizations, and Alaska's congressional delegation have appealed to the U.S. State Department to seek the greater oversight from the Canadian federal government. Groups are hoping Secretary of State John Kerry will invoke the Boundary Waters Treaty between the U.S. and Canada as a tool to encourage increased scrutiny of the KSM mine and other large projects. Lynch thinks there's a lack of oversight with projects proposed near rivers that flow out of British Columbia into southeast Alaska, and he says it's an economic issue for the fishing industry, not just an environmental one.
We have sustainable fisheries. Fisheries in southeast Alaska have gone on for about 100 years, and there's really no reason, barring some disaster, why it can't go on for another 100-plus years. However, you know, like with KSM, their mine life, they're estimating like 52 years. Well, I know fishermen here in Alaska that have been fishing themselves, individuals, for 50 years.
The state of Alaska's comments on the KSM mine are signed by the commissioners of three departments, Natural Resources, Fish and Game, and Environmental Conservation. Those comments note that a panel review of the project may serve to address some of the continuing concerns held by Alaskans. Kyle Moselle is large project coordinator for the Alaska Department of Natural Resources.
What the commissioners have essentially asked of the Minister of Environment is to fully consider those concerns and apply the most appropriate administrative process for addressing them.
Moselle says the state of Alaska has been involved in the review of the KSM mine going back to 2008. He says it's too early to say what actions should result from the tailings dam breach at Mount Pauley.
What the state of Alaska is really looking for is a thorough investigation of the events that led up to that dam breach. There's going to be a lot of information that still needs to be gathered. It needs to be investigated fully, and there will be a report that summarizes that investigation. I think that we'll be able to make better decisions as a state about what actions to take once we have that information.
The state's comments ask to review the plans for the tailings facility at the KSM mine, and the commissioners formally request to be included in the development of authorizations for the project. The state also requests to be included in the developing of monitoring plans associated with water quality, dam safety, and aquatic resources.
We have good working relationships with BC. We have good working relationships with the federal government of Canada, and we're building on those relationships as we move forward and as they move forward on the review of additional mining projects that are proposed.
New mines are also planned around the Stikine and Taku River watersheds. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
Five more conservation groups filed a lawsuit in U.S. District Court today in hopes of stopping the Big Thorn Timber Project on Prince of Wales Island. The plaintiffs are Cascadia Wildlands, the Greater Southeast Alaska Conservation Community, Greenpeace, Center for Biological Diversity, and the Boat Company. KRBD's Lila Carey has more.
The lawsuit cites a declining wolf population on Prince of Wales and states that the planned harvest of about 6,000 acres of old-growth rainforest would further injure wolves. Larry Edwards of the Sitka Greenpeace office says the lawsuit focuses on what he calls the suppression of science in the Forest Service's review of the timber project.
In not going through, following through on formal declarations by wolf expert Dr. Dave Person, who has done 22 years of research here on these wolves, and not following up on that and doing a supplemental EIS.
The Forest Service released a Supplemental Information Report, or SIR, on the Big Thorn project last week. Tongass National Forest Supervisor Forrest Cole writes that he did consider Dave Person's research for the SIR and concluded that a supplemental environmental impact statement was not needed. Cole acknowledges concerns about the wolf population, but writes that hunting and trapping regulations and enforcement would be the best protection for wolves. Edwards takes issue with that argument.
It's not just, you know, people going out and hunting under the fish and game regulations. There's also a huge amount of illegal take of wolves. And that illegal take in particular is related to the very high density of logging roads on the island.
The proposed Big Thorn harvest would include up to 46 miles of new roads and the opening or reconstruction of about 37 miles of existing road. Another concern in the lawsuits is deer habitat. Edward says it all works together.
You have a dynamic here between wolves and deer and hunters. And it's all got to fit together somehow. And it worked for a long, long time. But due to the habitat loss and also with the added complexity of the access that enables illegal take of wolves from all the logging roads, it's really upset that whole system.
The plaintiffs named in the lawsuit are Forrest Cole, Alaska Regional Forester Beth Pendleton, Forest Service Chief Tom Tidwell, and the U.S. Forest Service Agency as a whole. Another lawsuit seeking to stop the Big Thorn project was filed earlier by Earth Justice, representing the Juneau-based Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. That lawsuit also cites the potential negative impacts on deer and wolves. Forest Service officials haven't returned messages seeking comment on the court complaints, but in an interview right after the Supplemental Information Report was released, Cole said he expected the SIR would generate lawsuits. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Where can you see more than 1,000 entertainers, from Alaska Native dancers to dinosaurs? The Alaska State Fair. This year, everyone attending the fair can enjoy music free with fair admission, like Riders in the Sky, Young Dubliners, Redhead Express, Savannah Jack, Home Free, and Kentucky Lineman. Learn more at thealaskastatefair.org. Music, fair food, and good time fun. It's what the Alaska State Fair is all about. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska and the State of Alaska signed a memorandum of agreement on Monday, signifying a new level of communication and cooperation between the two entities, focusing on education, workforce training, and jobs. The governor's office says it's the first of its kind. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Central Council and the state already work together on a number of projects and initiatives, like the Village Public Safety Officer Program, financial assistance, and childcare. But Randy Ruraro says there can be even more collaboration. Ruraro is Special Counsel and Policy Director for Governor Sean Parnell.
We do a lot of the same things. You know, we do workforce training, we do early education, but we weren't talking to each other on a regular basis in some of them. And so I thought, well, I'll meet with Richard and just talk about it and see if we can try to formalize our relationship a little bit and get both sides talking and communicating.
Richard Peterson was elected president of Central Council in April. He says it's natural for the First People of Alaska to be working with the state of Alaska.
Anytime that we can utilize our programs with the state's programs to deliver better services to our communities and our people.
The MOA focuses on areas of common interest, like economic development, public safety, and energy. It establishes a systematic review of issues and programs by both entities to identify opportunities to work together. Peterson says it's already been a historic year for Alaska Natives, with the passage of two pieces of legislation recognizing Indigenous languages as official state languages and making November 14th Walter Sobeleff Day. He says the bills are a good start in further broadening the relationship with the state.
The next step now, I think, is to start making sure that legislation that represents our needs is being introduced. And so we need to start getting aggressive. And by aggressive, I don't mean that in any negative way. Really, it just means that we need to be at the table and we need to be active participants in what happens around us.
In light of the MOA, the state and Central Council have already started a new partnership working with Microsoft to bring educational opportunities and IT training to tribal members throughout Southeast and the state. Peterson says in order to foster the new relationship, Central Council has created a government affairs liaison position. On the state side, Ruaro will be taking the lead. At the MOA signing, Governor Sean Parnell said the management of the VPSO program in Southeast is a good example of an existing relationship between the state and Central Council, something the MOA will only make stronger.
We've worked to improve VPSO retention, but frankly, that's another area where I'm going to need additional work with Central Council on, and that's an issue statewide. Clinkin Haida has sought out federal funds for vehicles. You know, we've all kind of done our part to work to improve and enhance the VPSO coverage and the tools that they have.
The agreement between the state of Alaska and Central Council of the Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska is good for 3 years. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Until recently, no video games on the market have told the story of an Indigenous people from their perspective, but a group of Alaska Natives have partnered with a game developer to change that. The project is called Never Alone. KTOO's Heather Bryant reports.
In a high school in Barrow in far northern Alaska, students sit in a dark room. They're watching a demo of Never Alone, a game its creators hope will set a new standard in video game development. Like in movies, Native characters in video games tend towards stereotype, and few are heroes. But this game's different. It's based on a traditional story known as Kanuksayuka, and the experiences of Alaska elders, storytellers, and youth. The story follows a young Inupiaq girl and an Arctic fox as they go on an adventure to save her village from a blizzard that never ends. Game developer Sean Veshi has 20 years of experience in the industry working on action titles like Tomb Raider. He went to Barrow to watch the students play a demo of the game. He says that day was his most memorable experience from the project.
And it was such a special moment because they were literally sitting forward, you know, yelling and screaming at the players to avoid the enemies and to navigate around obstacles.
Veshi's introduction to Alaska Native storytelling began 2 years earlier. It arrived in boxes of transcribed stories. He says they contain tales and creatures as interesting and imaginative as anything in the movies today.
And we were just blown away at the richness, at the beauty, and the depth of that storytelling tradition. And we realized that none of that had really been ever explored in a video game.
Veshi made a dozen trips to Alaska with his team to gather more stories and imagery. Helping connect Veshi with the native stories was Amy Fredine, who is Inupiaq and the cultural ambassador between the developers and Indigenous storytellers. She says that in Native culture, everybody depends on each other, and that was the most important part of both the game's story and creating the game itself.
The last thing we wanted was to have this video game kind of be like a cultural appropriation. We didn't want this to be an outsider's view of what the Inupiaq culture was. We wanted it to come from the people themselves.
One connection Fredine made was with Jana Harcharik, who works in the Barrow School District to promote and preserve Inupiaq culture. Harcharek says when the students learned the developers wanted to hear from them, the kids began telling their own stories.
The ideas just started coming out. They were like, well, are you going to be able to maybe do this? Because I'm a whaler and I'm a hunter and I have this experience and it would be really cool if we could make this happen or that happen. There was a lot of excitement right from the start.
The whole idea for Never Alone came from the Cook Inlet Tribal Council in Anchorage. 2 years ago, President and CEO Gloria O'Neill asked developers if games could be used to share traditional stories. O'Neill says the Tribal Council was looking to invest its money in a way that would also benefit Native culture.
And we started thinking about the future because our board also said to us is never forget who we are and where we come from, but think about how we can connect with our young people in the future.
Over time, O'Neill started to believe that the perfect way to do that is through video games, something people in even the most remote parts of Alaska want to play.
Not only we could make money with the right partners, but that we had a medium in which we could share our culture with the world, that we could create this invitation of courageous learning with the world.
The video game Never Alone is slated for release later this year. I'm Heather Bryant in Juneau.
The winning giant pumpkin was weighed in at the Alaska State Fair today in Palmer.
1,283 pounds!
In case you missed that, the best of three entries tipped the scale at 1,283 pounds. Pumpkin grower Dale Marshall of Anchorage took first and second place because he grew all three entries in today's contest. But the big orange pumpkin missed breaking the state record by a mere 3 pounds.
3.5 pounds would have tied it. It was the J.D. Meckleson's record down at Nikiski. Yeah, I thought it was going to weigh a little bit more, but oh well, you know. Glad I had them this year. Yeah, I really did.
Marshall's two other entries literally paled by comparison to the winner. The two white pumpkin entries weighed 780 and 753 pounds. The state fair runs through Labor Day. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Jovic Nikki in Petersburg, Layla Carey in Ketchikan, and Lisa Fu and Heather Bryant in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Anchorage and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.